podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
I'm in. It's sending you an approval notification.
Is it? Okay.
So you need to say, you need to
click. God, this is against every instinct in my human body.
I know.
Like, yeah. God, this is awful, Tom. What are you doing?
Everything you've been told about hackers is true, and I am about to sell your data. There is no podcast. There is no podcast. Welcome along, it's my mate Porter Toaster. This week I've got a brilliant stand-up and writer, and also Athena Koblenyu, a very prolific mother at the moment. You're doing some serious mothering right now.
I'm literally just pushing them out one after the other, like a tennis ball machine, just firing them over the net, aces all round. Yeah.
Ooh, I just, do you know, I was enjoying that image so much, Athena. I just spat in my own face. Do you know how I did that?
Well, there you go. Why go to Thailand when you can talk to me about children flying out left, right, and centre? Why? We can't go anyway. So
I let my head right back, and I went, thunk, and then spit landed right on my own face. God, this has been already a very exciting episode of My Mate Bought a Toaster. So you are mid-parenting. You've got two kids in the house. You have no other adults, so you're in charge of those kids. So at any moment, you might have to leap up and do some parenting, right? This is good jeopardy.
Yeah. Oh, the stakes are high. You know, the stakes are really high. So everyone needs to continue to listen to this because anything could happen. You know, I've got a little 11. This one now, to the left of me, 12 weeks old, vomits at any, you know, just vomits randomly. Oh, just little vomits, like little puke. We call him pukey.
Yeah, but that's why they came up with the word possiting. that's what the little baby vomits are called, possiting. Wouldn't say that to a bloke throwing himself, coming out of a pub at midnight. You wouldn't say, oh, look, he's possiting up his pizza there. Oh, sweet.
The possiting's not a good nickname, is pukey.
Pukey
McPukey.
So you've got a pukey McPuker face next to you. Yeah. Great news. And then you've got another child who at any moment could become active.
Like a volcano. Just like the active is the right word. And active volcano because she's like a little monster, but also volcano because of the diarrhea that children get. So it's like a reverse volcano. So, you know, it's all going on here. It's all going on.
All the fluids on this episode of My Mate Bought a Toaster. And we're diving straight back into your past. We're going 16 years into the past.
16? Whoa. Is it six? Okay. Have I been using Amazon for 16 years?
2005, the 28th of April, right?
Wow, that's a long time.
You're living in Camden Town at this point.
I was working there, so I must have been getting stuff delivered to Camden.
All right, so you were working on Arlington Road.
Oh my God, are you reading addresses? Yes, I was working on Arlington Road. Yeah, I used to work on Arlington. Yes, I used to work in for Camden Council, and they've got a depot in Arlington Road. I had some wonderful. Oh, can you hear that?
Lovely.
Let me stick a dummy in his mouth. Bear with me one second.
Great. Oh, you've got to get the dummies in there.
Oh, you're so good. Where's it gone? I just saw
it. This is why you need to buy 6,000 dummies.
Right, it's okay. He's cool now.
Sure?
He's fine now. Right, he's sorted. Arlington Road, yes. I used to work in a depot in Camden for Camden Council. I used to work I was doing admin for like a waste department. There's not a lot I don't know about waste and refuse now and recycling. Now we're on the topic. But I was working there and it was great. And it was a proper yard. It was full of like street cleaners and bin men and geezers. In those days you could drink on the job. So I'd go to like Weatherspoons every day and have a beer and a burger. It was a great time. Yeah, it was a great time.
Would you come back from just a one-woman boozy lunch at the old Weatherspoons?
It's more like with a warm, fuzzy feeling. I wouldn't be like drunk, but I'd just have like probably like a shandy and a pint. So I'd have a pint and then chase it with a shandy. I was
refuse administration is best done slightly tipsy.
It's not the kind of thing you do if you take your life seriously. You know, like it's the kind of thing you do if you like to have boozy lunches. It's not like being a lawyer, is it?
It's very good preparation. It's more important. It's very good preparation for dealing with the comedy circuit. It was really getting you trained up nice and early for that shit.
There's a lot of banter when you work with bin men. Absolutely. So it's just like the open mic circuit working with those guys. And that I definitely owe them something. Like my success is based on the fact I used to work with bin men. Absolutely.
Why? Because what sort of, when you say there's good banter, was it like, you know, was it quite personal? Was it just always very funny? Like, what do you mean?
It was funny. I think if you're going to work in waste and refuse at any level, you're going to be down to earth. Thinking about it seriously. Because I worked there for 5 years, and I have to say, I think I laughed every day. It was a very funny place to work. And I think you just have to be down to earth if you work in that environment. And you deal with a lot of... People take their bins very seriously.
Yeah, when they tried to move a refuse collection to every other week.
It's...
Oh!
Not even every other week. Sometimes you would just change the day for whatever reason, and people would just be like, but my bin day's a Tuesday. And you think, well, it's a Thursday now. Like, what's up, Diane? Chill out. Like, it's a Thursday. Like, so people, and if you sort of miss a bin, like, okay, it happens. Like, people make mistakes, but I guess it's very frustrating when your bin isn't emptied, but the way people act is just like, you'd think that you'd run over their dog or their cat or something. It's remarkable. When you deal with people who take life very, who take their bins very seriously, it does give you a sense of humour. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? This is like the sort of, you know, they say that, I heard someone say the other day that any human who's got a problem with their arsehole, basically everything physical about us comes down to our arsehole. If we've got any kind of issues with our arsehole, that's it. The whole human personality falls apart. We cannot cope. It's the same societally. We cannot cope if the bin situation falls apart. That's it. And everything else falls apart straight away.
Oh, well, absolutely. It's the backbone of public service sort of bin collections, more so than the NHS and the fire brigade and paramedics and all this stuff. Like if the bin men go, I should say bin people, I should say waste operatives.
Good.
Hygiene waste operatives, whatever they were called officially at the time. But if they go down the drain, if they go on strike, and there were bin strikes, right? Like in the 70s, and it was awful. We don't remember that, by the way.
Obviously not. Obviously not. We're way too young for that.
Being an only just about millennial, I don't have a clue about that.
Yeah. All right. So April 2005, you bought a Sony MZ-N520 Blue Net mini disc.
Fuck yeah. And it was amazing. Yes, I did. And I used it for years. And I used to make mixtapes, and I still have my mini, I have my mini discs. They're literally in the cupboard behind me. I still have my mini discs. I used that religiously. I used it in the gym. I took on holiday with me. I don't know why mini discs died. Okay. The mini disc was the greatest format ever invented. I even bought an actual mini disc hi-fi. I still have it. It's a hi-fi. So I also bought the non-portable mini disc player. I just thought mini discs were great. I thought they were the future. And they weren't.
How has the minidisc aged? I mean, this is great. We've got a live minidisc user. A little bit of research into the minidisc over time. Do they still work okay?
I don't use it anymore. Like,
I'm not a fucking idiot.
I haven't played a minidisc for about 10 years. But at the time, I never went anywhere without it, and it was small and it was really good quality, and it had that thing that you could do where you could, let's say you bought a mini disc and it could like play 60 minutes of kind of music. You could,
wasn't it always an odd number? Wasn't it like 72 minutes?
Weird. It would always be like 94, 95. Yeah. What you could do is there was like a button you could press so you could get like four times the length of music on it for slightly less quality. And I think you could do that with VHS and cassette tapes too. You could do that thing where if you had like a 60-minute cassette tape, you could make it 120 minutes. I can't remember what the buttons were. So I used to walk around with like, now you have like all of the music ever on Spotify. Yeah. But I used to think I was bad because I had like a four-hour mini disc full of music.
Because you hacked mini discs. You hacked them.
It wasn't even a hack. It was like a button you could press. That was how it worked. That was the USP.
So good. So good. And I love the fact that you've bought this and, you know, you've refused to throw it away. Maybe because of your history in refuse, you know that this doesn't, you know, you don't want this to go into the bin because you know what happens.
Actually, you will know this because you're a sensible person that loves the earth. You've got to reduce, reuse before you recycle. Okay. So good. That's why I didn't throw it away. I mean, it doesn't work. It literally just stopped working.
It should be reduce, reuse, and hoard.
Hoard. You got to keep it because I want something to show the kids.
Yeah, and also I want my kids to deal with all my shit when I die. You know, I'll be in some godforsaken bungalow and they'll be like, what is this mini disc?
Exactly. What? I want them to make a shrine. And that shrine needs to be made of pointless things that don't work anymore, that they don't understand. Yes. Well, the people will need something to come to when I go. I'm thinking of the people. That's what I'm thinking of.
What will they remember you by?
Exactly.
You know, one of the greats, Athena Kablet. Let's see what we know. Let's go through her belongings. Look at this mini display. What does this tell us about her?
And they buried Bin Laden at sea because they didn't want to create like a memorial for him. And let's say I get buried at sea for whatever, you know, nefarious reason. Like, I will need items that can then be constructed to make this memorial. That won't be possible because I'll be at the bottom of the Pacific. So, you know, these are all, there's a method to the madness is what I'm saying.
I like the idea of planning your tomb. That is great. I've never taken this podcast in that direction. 2006, March. Again, it's the only thing you've bought all year. You've gone for a mini MP3. 512 megabytes. So you've gone for a nice mini display there. Gone for a nice MP3.
Is that a creative one? What brand is it?
ATMT, this one.
I don't even, I have no recollection of that. It sounds like an absolute piece of junk. It sounds like something. So I used to order a lot of stuff online that would never get delivered. There was so much fraud in the early 2000s with online shopping. And that sounds like something I never owned because I don't have any recollection of it. And it was so common, you would lose your money and you'd have to just get on with your life. It sounds like I never received that.
It's the early noughties equivalent of Instagram shopping, isn't it?
Yes.
It's absolute garbage. Well, it's a lovely little device. It looks exactly like a dongle now. And it's got also, it's really sweet because it's put USB. There's a big, bright, prominent logo of USB. Like, oh my God, the future. It's USB. Whoa, it's amazing.
As opposed to what we used before, which was, I don't know what we used before USB.
String.
Yeah, we just tied computers up with string.
String things.
And we just used them for decoration. We didn't realise we could link them up and have them be useful. Computer bunting,
that's what, do you know what? That would be a good bit of reusing. Just turning all this old tech into bunting, just making necklaces out of old MP3 players with 212 megabytes or whatever capacity.
A robot necklace.
There you go, a robot necklace. 2007, she's bought absolutely nothing. It's gone quiet. It's like you've only bought Amazon really for music. Oh, then 2008, you're back again. A couple of books here. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, the 20th century classics.
Yeah, great book. Yeah, it's about how what it is to be an African American in America at that time it was written. Famously, the man is nameless in the book. Anyway, it's not very subtle when you think about it, Ralph. now I'm saying it out loud. I don't remember buying the book, but I still have the book on my bookshelf. It's right. It's in my bookshelf in my house.
I think, harsh to criticize Ralph for
it's like a really like well-esteemed book. I can't believe I had something bad to say about it. Can you cut that out, please? I sound like a dickhead.
No, I'll put up the volume for that bit. I'll make it go even louder. It's a Penguin classic from 1969, The Invisible Man, by Ralph Ellison. It's got loads of, wow, look at all these reviews on here. Top reviews, five stars. Five stars are excellent and still relevant. Difficult but compelling read. A really powerful book about race in America in the 1950s. Strong themes of the trickster make this a compelling read, though it does drag on at times. All right, sorry to this reviewer who's said that. Worth reading as a snapshot of history and historical literature. Don't expect it to be easy, though.
It's not easy. It's a depressing read, and it's challenging because the protagonist is a victim of society, but he's a victim of his own decisions as well. So it's one of those things where you're like, oh my God, the world is crap. But also this man's response to the world is doing him no good. So
it's really doubled down the victimhoodness there.
Absolutely. Ugh. Yeah, absolutely. Which is important because something that a lot of these narratives don't have is agency for the main character. You can't just walk around going white supremacy. Like, we have agency as well. And so that's why the book is quite challenging.
Yes. Good. Okay, excellent. All right, that was in 2007. Skipping ahead to 2010 now, Athena. We've got The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. Whatever happened
to
him?
I'm coming off as such an intellectual. This is amazing. Mate, I'm so glad I'm doing this.
Absolutely. Deep. Seriously impressed with you. Yeah, of course, pure garage rewind back to the old school.
I still have that double CD. I know exactly the CD, and it's wicked. But going back to The Bridge, let's bring it back to the bridge. David Remnick, one of my favorite writers, even though he's a bit problematic.
Sholama, Sticky on here as well. Agent X, Double 99, great classics. Bands, great
these
artists.
These are all classics that if I was to play this right now, it would just be a little rave, a little podcast rave.
so good. Yeah, maybe you listen. Do you listen to Little Big Garage while reading about Barack Obama? Is that
exactly,
a good soundtrack?
Because it's important to be like highbrow and lowbrow. And Garage is highbrow, actually. No, I'm not having this. Look, yes,
yeah,
I do listen
go
to.
On, yeah.
I listen to Garage whilst reading books written by the current editor of the New York Times. Absolutely. Why wouldn't I? Why would I not do that? It makes complete and utter sense. Vitamins B and C and D. Get it for myself, for my health, on the cheap.
Gotta stay in shape, but I'm so lazy. Prime online, next day delivery. What are you doing with your life, by the way, in 2010? What's
2010? I'm going through a gross misconduct hearing with my current employer.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that because you were pissed after the lunchtime beer and burgers?
Do you know what? I wish I was, because then I'd have an excuse. I was sending some dodgy emails, like just emails with bad language. And they found them because I was doing it for like a year and a half. So they didn't just find one email and told me to calm it down. They just stored them all up. And then they done me for gross misconduct. So I was going through that. That was a civil service job.
Did you get sacked?
No, I kept my job. I kept it. They couldn't pin nothing on me.
Amazing.
Which is amazing. Thank God. I mean, I'm very grateful I kept my job at that time. But then I was actually the whole process was so embarrassing. I handed in my notice close after that. It was the best thing I could have done. But that was funny. I was also riding. I used to teach people how to ride bikes, so I was doing that on the side because my job was so boring. I was like, I've got to do something else in my life. I know, I'll just ride my bike all day.
So you were double bubbling. You were working in the civil service and sending absolutely filthy potty mouthed emails.
Yeah.
Right, and then you were also a cycling instructor.
Yeah, so I'd have to, sometimes I'd go into schools, but I never really developed that part, but you can go into schools and teach kids how to ride bikes. So I'd be like a assistant instructor there. But what I tended to do was just go to people's houses, and it would be people who were like wanting to ride their bike to work basically, but they'd never ridden on the road before. So then I would take them out for a couple of hours and we'd just go, it'd be like, this is how you indicate left. This is how you indicate right. This is how you use a roundabout. And I'd teach them about their gears, and some of them would be interested in like bike mechanics. So I'd teach them a little bit about, you know, how to, you know, have their bike not be shit. And that was a great job, horrible pay. And you'd meet these mammals, middle-aged men in lycra who just try to like prove how fast they were by like outrunning you. And you'd just be like, I'm a bandy-legged 28-year-old. Like, you're impressing no one, you know, like I'm here to teach you how to ride a bike. You know what I mean? So just like keep it social.
are you suggesting that, and I wouldn't want to cast any aspersions, but there's a certain type of mammal who has a bit of a chip on their shoulder and is ultra competitive?
I'm suggesting that is the case, yes.
you shock me.
It was always really pleasant to teach women how to ride, because there was humility there. Like, they would be genuinely scared of riding on the road and they would genuinely want help to ride their bikes from A to B without getting run over and becoming bonnet pizza.
Bonnet pizza! Oh, God.
We used to say this to the kids. We'd be like, and what happens if you don't look? Bonnet pizza! Which I look back and that's probably not the ideal.
Curb quiche! Let's keep going!
Asphalt meatballs and all that. So sort of women tended to be like really grateful, and a lot of guys would be like, oh, I don't know why I'm doing this, it's just my workplace maybe do it. And you just sort of think, Jesus Christ, like they're paying, and your workplace is paying for this, you know what I mean? Just enjoy the ride.
Do you think when they turned up and saw a young woman on a bike who was their teacher, do you think they had issues at that moment where they're like, the fuck? This course must be Mickey Mouse.
Possibly, yeah. I think, they must have thought, especially because I'm very, not anti like professional cycling, but I always think if you want people to ride bikes, Lycra and £4,000Tifosi's aren't going to cut it, you know. So I had like a normal road bike. I'd turn up in, I'd wear jeans on my bike, for example. I'd wear normal clothes, so they would sort of think that's not serious. And I'm like, riding a bike is like what children do. It shouldn't be something that is like you've got to go to Evans and buy all this stuff, and you've got to have your feet stuck to your pedals, like you're going to Tesco's. Like, so I was always like an advocate for just like down to earth every day, get on your bike and go to where you're going cycling, as opposed to lifestyle cycling. So
you're,
I think,
right, that you're so right. It's so weird though that you get that a certain type of, and it is, I'm afraid, often a certain type of middle-aged white man who does this, who turns to cycling which is ultimately a kid's thing. It's not like you don't get, you know, middle-aged men suddenly really getting into hopscotch. Like they really turn on bikes and they have to, they feel like, I don't know, maybe it was the sort of post 2012 Olympics thing and sort of this winning the Tour de France as British people then suddenly started doing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But Team Sky. Team Sky have a lot to answer for in terms of making cycling into, but also British cycling in general. Like I used to be well into like the cycling community and campaigning and stuff like that. And I just kind of lost interest. I think there was one specific thing. There was a big old annual conference from, I think it was from British Cycling did it. I can't remember. It was just like a national cycling organization. And I got an invite and it was at this golf club in the middle of nowhere. And I just thought, for me, I just sort of think cycling is like such a positive thing for people. It's great for cities. It's great for people living in the countryside. It's great for kids. It's great for adults. It's great for old people. We should be doing everything in our power to make it as inclusive and accessible as possible. And you're holding your big national conference that you want everyone to go to in the middle of nowhere in this golf club. And I just thought it just stinks of privilege and ignorance. And it, like, this is not going to result in the change you want to see, which is just people just kind of riding bikes. So I kind of lost interest in, and like on the other end of the spectrum you get people who want to like turn big cities into little Amsterdams, and like Amsterdam's a city with about a million people that's completely flat. Like it's just not gonna work. So you get the hippies on one end and you get the mammals on the other end, and it's just like, oh, chaos. So I withdrew from all of that kind of malarkey.
Ironically, you walked away from
I
the
walked away
world.
From it, yeah.
Kiss them always. I can't kiss them always. Richard and Greta gonna make your lives better today
if you subscribe to our podcast.
You know, it's all about how to get the most out of your partner.
And we're partners,
so we know all about it.
It's good. Get it wherever you want to get it, when you go and get it from your podcast place. Richard and Greta.
You know?
You know?
Patreon, Patreon, patreon.com/toasterpod.
We've got Up From Slavery, an autobiography of Booker T. Washington.
Yes, it's really, it's one of those essential reads. It's one of those books that everyone told you to read when it was Black History, Black Lives Matter, or whatever, last summer. And that was on the reading list. I mean, it's a very middle class book. And it it's very conservative in the sense that, you know, we have to rise up with hard work and fortitude and all that stuff. It's just, I have that book, it's on my bookshelf as well. Don't know what to say about it, really. I don't think it's as helpful as we think it is, actually. But Booker T. Washington,
because the idea is you don't change the system, you just fight harder. Was that what you said?
Yeah, there's an element of kind of pull your socks up about it, which is important. But it's only
part of it.
I always think that you should read ruminations from across the spectrum if you're trying to read progressive books, and that is from a part of the spectrum that's important to understand, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. Also in June 2011, An Image of Africa, The Trouble with Nigeria.
Yeah, great book. Chinua Achebe. Yeah, written in the 70s, early 80s, I think. Very short book, almost like a long essay, but a very important book if you're interested in post-colonial Nigeria.
Right, okay. Oh, I feel like I should
bet you never imagined it. You didn't imagine it. You thought, I'll get a Fina one and she'll have ordered toasters with radios on them. You know, like garbage. Here we are talking about post-colonial Nigeria.
I've worked with you. I know, this doesn't surprise me at all. I know that you're going to be reading this stuff. It's just really interesting. The Rise and Fall of Marks and Spencer by Judy Bevan.
I bought that because I did a postgrad in business development. And that was a book that we needed, and it was just never in the library. So I just bought that off of Amazon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got a distinction for that. It's FYI. FYI.
You had to tell me that. Yeah. It's impossible not to say. I did, there was a thing called the English Speaking Board exam when I was 10, and I got a distinction in that. And if ever I, for whatever reason, tell people about an English Speaking Board exam, I also have to say straight away, I got a distinction.
It's just like important. It's a very important point that I did a postgrad in. It was management or business management or something.
Yeah.
This is what was crazy. My employer paid for it at the time, and my employer was the people that done me for gross misconduct.
No way.
Isn't that funny? So that's how little I respect my employer. Like, they were paying for me to do a degree and I was just faffing about all day on their email system, which is terrible. Which is, you know, I'm very glad that I don't do that anymore. Because if I'd stayed in the workplace, I don't know what, I'd be done for treason or something. Like, it would have gotten bad. It would have been bad.
I'm desperate to know, what were you doing on the emails?
Just
what,
everything.
Come on, check her emails. It's getting like Hillary Clinton.
It was bad. It was worse than Clinton. It was just,
oh,
it was
wow.
just like, you know, there was a lot, because I was talking to two like friends, like, you know, so think about what you chat about with your friends, you know, like,
yeah,
and it, you know, it got intimate. You know, we're talking about dating, birds and the bees. So we weren't using language like birds and the bees, obviously.
No.
So, so yeah, a lot of my personal life was revealed in that tribunal. Definitely. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's hilarious. I bet you're like, you know, come on, WhatsApp. Why didn't you exist back then? It would have been so much easier.
God, wouldn't it? Back then you had to delete your text messages when it got too full. So obviously you were going to use email because it was just convenient.
Of course. Of course. I checked my text messages the other day on my iMessage. I've got 8 gigabytes of text messages on my phone. 8 gigabytes.
Could you imagine? And it's like, you've got to keep the receipts, right? You've got to keep them. These are receipts. Yeah. So,
well, again, part of my my digital tomb, as we discussed earlier on. You know, I've got to keep all this stuff. Telling my story.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, it's like that Black Mirror episode where they resurrect that guy based on his social media profile.
Oh, I've not seen that.
Oh, it's one of the early ones. I think it's one of the Channel 4 ones. It's a pretty old one, but they resurrect somebody who dies and they use the social media profile to kind of like get him like really accurate. There are things that I don't put online. So it won't be accurate if they do it to me. It would just be like my online persona. And I don't know if that's, it would just, so I'd be, like, it'd be a shame because I guess my online persona is a bit of an asshole. So it'd be a misrepresentation of me, I think, which is a shame. But I should probably do start to be a bit nicer online.
Do you think somewhere Lawrence Fox is saying the same thing? I am a bit of an asshole online. Do you think I should be nicer? Do you think I should let them know the truth?
Yeah. Yes, I think that's exactly what he's saying. He's probably a gentleman offline.
Absolutely lovely guy, I'm sure. Let's move on. Nightclubbing, Grace Jones.
Yeah,
brilliant
great
Grace
album.
Jones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a brilliant album.
Yeah, Slave to the Rhythm as well. 4th of June, 2012. So good. Condoleezza Rice, a memoir of my extraordinary, ordinary family and me.
So Condoleezza Rice, that's basically what she did was she had a memoir and then she decided to write a memoir that was specifically for young readers. So that's a really quick book to read. It's basically for like teenagers and it's about her life.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, and it's just basically what I really like about it is because a lot of people might be like, Condoleezza Rice served for Bush, Republican, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of the things that she believes and a lot of her childhood and her pathway into kind of politics is really, I think, instructive for people who maybe want to get into that line of work, so to speak, but maybe don't come from backgrounds that are, you'd normally, you know, you don't expect someone like Condoleezza Rice, who comes from like segregated Birmingham, Alabama, to speak fluent Russian, be an expert in Middle Eastern foreign policy, she's like a incredibly high level figure stakes skater. She used to compete for America.
What?
Yeah, yeah. And she's a classically trained pianist. So she talks about the household environment that engendered that kind of thirst for learning. And she talks about her decision-making process into kind of becoming a kind of politician. And she just talks about kind of like she talks about race like a lot, really. And it's just what I like about it is it's really, especially now, we're in this habit of going, oh, well, you're right wing, you're conservative, you're the enemy. And it's like I defy anyone to read that book in particular, and especially if they're left wing, and disagree with the things she says. She's actually really sensible about when she talks about kind of having high attainment, but coming from, you know, a generally kind of oppressed part of the population. It's a really great book. I really like it. I can't wait for my kids to read it. I hope they get something from it. They probably won't. They'll probably be like, Mum, I just want to read like Just 17 and Secret 7 or whatever the fuck kids read. But I think that's a really good book. I recommend it to a lot of people with kind of older kids who are looking to think about what they want to do with their lives.
It's such an important idea, though, to present your life to a younger reader. That's something I've never.
Especially if you're a high achiever, like she's an absolute, like I said, she's just what's the word I'm looking for when you're talented at? It's a polymath. She's a polymath. And so when you're that kind of person, I think it's really good to kind of just open your brain up like an onion and just unpeel it for people.
Yes, to present it to the world for scientific examination.
Yeah, and also it's really easy to see people at the end of their journeys and not understand the kind of the 10,000 hours that it took to get to where they are. I mean, she was almost seconding. People talk about Kamala Harris and where she's second vice president, but, she, you know, Condoleezza Rice was not a million miles away from that kind of authority at all.
And so, do you think because she's regarded, well, she's technically she's right wing, she's a Republican, but because she's regarded as that, as a role model, so as a woman of colour, as a role model, do you think she's been passed over a bit?
Absolutely. It's a real blind spot people on the left have. Like, conservatives have always elevated non-white people into senior positions faster than left-wingers. This is always, look at the conservative cabinet now. When Labour were in power 15 years, they never had one non-white cabinet member. That was, and he was cabinet member for something boring. Like, it was like, it was a ridiculous, I can't even, do you know something?
Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely true, yeah. I can't remember his name. Oh, anyway, you can Google this. It was in the 90s. He became the first black cabinet member. But that was it. Whereas if you, now we've got Priti Patel, Sajid Javid was obviously in the cabinet, Rishi Sunak is the chancellor. I mean, this is just, I get it. Like, you don't, like, representation doesn't mean, like, if their politics are bad, then their politics are bad. But the truth is that right wing governments tend to elevate non-white people more than left wing governments do. This is just, you look at it, that's how it is. So, there's definitely a tendency to kind of gloss over those achievements.
This is such an important comment. So it's Paul Botang.
Botang, yes, thank you. So what was he cabinet office for?
This is the thing. So
it was something really crappy. It was like...
Yeah. 2002, he yesterday entered the history books as Britain's first black cabinet minister, a full 110 years since the election of the first non-white MP at Westminster. He was appointed as the chief secretary to the Treasury. I mean, I don't know. There are definitely much bigger jobs in the cabinet.
Yeah, it's not one of the headline ones, is it? Ghanaian, Paul. Paul. So, you know, like I said, Labour had a lot of years to establish a kind of precedent for just representation.
Do you know what that feels like? It feels like when you find out that women weren't allowed to vote. I'm sure there's a fact about this. Women weren't allowed to vote in Switzerland until the 1960s or 70s.
Oh, like, yeah. I was reading about that the other day. It was on the news as well. Just going back to Condoleezza Rice, she talks about why she's a Republican. And it's a really simple reason. Her parents went to register to vote in the Democrats' office. They went, we want to register as voters. We want to register as Democrats. And the Democrats wouldn't allow them. So they were like, oh, we'll be Republican then. And that's why the family became a Republican family. They were denied registration through the Democratic Party. This was in Birmingham, Alabama. So, and again, like, people forget, but, like, before civil rights were enacted, those were democratic governments in America. So it's just basically this binary line we have between left and right, and particularly in America, Democratic and Republican, and even here, Conservative and Labour. That binary line is actually a lot more, there's a lot more osmosis than we like to acknowledge.
It reminds me of Nimco Ali. Do you know Nimco?
Yes, I know Nimco, like a really divisive figure, because she's somebody who left people like, but also she champions right wing kind of ideals. Like,
she's a fellow Welshie as well. She certainly spent a lot of time in her childhood in Cardiff, and she ended up, she approached Boris Johnson in the street to talk about FGM.
Yes.
And she says he was absolutely amazing. He was the only, but she was writing emails and letters to her MPs who happened to be Labour, and they were not doing anything. And she approached him in the street when he was mayor, and he was absolutely amazing. And same with Gove. And they both followed up on it. And this, you know, sticks in my throat because I'm a Labour voter. Well, I'm certainly, you know, I'm not a Tory. And, you know, it's just a fact, and as a result, she is now signed up Tory.
Absolutely. And why shouldn't she be? There's actually nothing wrong with being a conservative. Like, having most of us, and when I say us, I mean people from kind of like let's call them southern hemisphere countries, come from conservative countries. You know, like, we come from places with no welfare state, for example. We come from places where you have to pay for education, and we think that's normal. You know, we come from places where it's like, work hard, start a business, go to university, get a degree, and all that kind of stuff. These are very conservative ideals. So we don't just kind of like land on in the UK and just be like, hey, we're liberal now. What is very true about Nimco Ali's experiences is that because of the racism in the left that is that maybe isn't acknowledged, they'll be like, oh, okay, well, we don't want to talk about FGM because we don't want to say like, oh, this, you know, people from these countries are bad or people from these Muslim churches are bad or whatever. But it's like, there are people here that need help. You can't, do you know what I mean? Like, you have to, if you see bad practices in people's cultures or religions that need to stop, then you need to talk about them. You can't just say, oh, we don't want to talk about them because we don't want to look racist. That in itself is racist. And also, you just got me on something. Like, it's really important. When we talk about patriarchy, we only ever talk about kind of like white male patriarchy, but patriarchy is just crushing people all over the world, in India, in the Congo, in Eastern Africa, in South Africa. And like, it's not racist to talk about these things at all. Like, white male patriarchy is nowhere near as bad as the kind of patriarchy you face up to, like that where people having to deal with in South Africa, for example, where you'll just get murdered if you're like a black lesbian, like the, you know, or in America, you know, if you're a black trans woman, your life expectancy is like 40 or something. Like, this is the stuff we need to talk about because it's happening and people are victims of it. And the thing is, we are talking about it, but we do need kind of like quote unquote white allies to kind of like run with it. And that's exactly what happened to Nim Kowali. She talked to Boris, she talked to Michael, and they were like, what's happening is awful. We want to help you. So when we talk about kind of like the racism in the left and their blind spots and the frustrations we kind of feel, that's, you know, a lot of that is actually Nim Kowali's story really encapsulates that.
Yeah, yeah. It is absolutely fascinating stuff. It really is. And it's complex, right? It's complex.
I'm going to challenge on that. It's actually not complex at all. I think it's the least complex thing in the world to see what's happening in front of your face and deal with it objectively.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of hand-wringing on the left.
Yes, that's what I meant.
Hand-wringing. And it's like, this is a woman who is saying, we want to stop cutting girls. We're tired of it. Okay, we want to stop. And there shouldn't be any debate or argument about the fact that it needs to stop and that we need to strategize ways to end it. And
I think what I mean by, and you're right, this challenge around it, obviously, is by complicated, I mean this sort of sensitivity. I think I feel really scared to offend and to get tangled up in saying the wrong thing. And that stalls people's instincts, which instincts, like you just said, of course should be, well, this has to stop. Well, this can't go forward. But people get stalled and people become paralyzed by fear of offending people.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is the problem.
I think that's the problem. And that means that people are trying to be progressive for the wrong reasons. If you're trying to be progressive to look good, then obviously you're going to second guess everything you say. But if you're trying to be progressive because you just want equality and you want the world to be a better place, you'll be happy to stumble into maybe like incorrect waters because you'll be happy to be corrected. Does that make sense? So, and I think that's the one thing I will say, it is a little easier if you're not white because, you know, like you talk about race all the time. I mean, we don't wake up and be like, oh my God, race. But what I mean is the lexicon of race is really kind of natural if you are a non-white person because it's something you learn from a young age, there's something not quite right about the world and you can then talk about it. If the lexicon of race is kind of new to you, it's harder, I think, to manage. You know, if you're getting it from a place of this is your life experience, then it's easy. But if you're getting it from a place of you have to do this, does that make sense? If it's coming from if you can avoid it, and sadly you can avoid it if you're white because you can just go for your life and be, yeah, it's great. If you can avoid it, you have to make an actual choice to do it and talk about it. And with that choice has to come a lot of learning, and not everyone can, but obviously learning, and if you don't do the learning, then it can be very uncomfortable.
I feel like I want to be on a bike with you by a roundabout, but instead of cycling on the road, I need you to guide me through this, because it's true. You know, I can remember saying when I was like 21, 22 and first doing stand-up, you know, there's loads of great comics of colour and stuff, and I'd say he's great because he talks about being black all the time. And fuck, you know, I look back now, that's the best part of 20 years ago, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, I mean, I had no idea.
Yeah, and it's...
I had no idea.
It is funny because, like, first of all, race is just a wonderful, rich vein to pull humour from, but white comics talk about being white all the time. It's just,
of course they do.
You just take it for granted, right?
Well, that's seen as the default.
When you talk about your hood extractor, your aluminium hooded extractor fan or fabric conditioner, I don't know. I sound like I've got no white friends. Like, this is what the other people do. They use fabric conditioner. I don't know. What I mean is, like, just that, the, you know, poor... who's a northern fat guy?
Peter Kay
talks about being white all the time. That's his whole act. This is, you know, that's literally, you know, Alan Carr talks about being a white gay man all the time. That is how, you know, Sarah Milligan talks about being a white woman all the time. That's literally her act, you know. Yeah. This isn't criticism, by the way. So if I go on stage and talk about supermalt and cocoa butter, I'm just talking about my life, you know. So it's that realization that, oh, I'm white and I have a race too. Yes. You know, that's a really important realization. So like, we all have a race. This is not something that is, it's just that the power structure means we have different life experiences based on that, but we all have a race.
And it is, what annoys me then is, so for example, the thing you just said about white people have a race too, and we have to understand that. And that's something which really I sort of learned when I read Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. Like that, reading that book just made me go, oh, fuck. Like it's, you know, this series of things. And I was really like the woke thing. Of feeling like, yeah, I feel like I have awoken up to this thing that is happening. And yet the way that the word woke has been weaponized as a negative now really fucking pisses me off. Like, it really pisses me off because I only see that as a positive thing. I know some people take woke maybe too far, and I understand there are some, you know, there's some extreme examples where arguments come about and blah, blah, blah. But as a sort of core idea of stopping, looking at the privilege that you live in, checking it, and then looking out onto other people and trying to learn and understand and take the criticism when you say the wrong thing. Like, that's only a positive thing. That's only going to help.
I think, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely a champion of the word progressive. Like, don't we want to just constantly be in a state of forward motion as people? And I mean, woke is basically African-American terminology that kind of is... Black people just took over generally, and now everyone uses it. But it just means, like, woke used to mean like knowledge of self. It used to mean, as Black people, do you understand why we straighten our hair? Do you understand why light-skinned people are more preferred to dark-skinned people? Do you understand the conditioning? And then, okay, fine, do you understand that we come from a big continent where there was lots of history before slavery and all this stuff? That's what woke meant. Woke just meant we are indoctrinated under this kind of like education system which teaches us about whiteness and Europeanness. So be woke, like undo all of that and unlearn all of that and find a better place to kind of form your identity from actual facts that haven't been adulterated with this like kind of corruption. And that's a good thing. And everyone can do that. Being woke is brilliant. And the kind of people who don't like being woke are the kind of people who either A, don't understand it, and a lot of people don't understand it, by the way. I think there's a genuine misunderstanding as to what it means, because obviously it comes from a space they don't occupy. It comes from a Black space. So if you're not in that space, you're not going to understand it. And some of it comes from people who do understand it, and they're terrified by it because it means they will lose things. They will lose their statues of people that look like them. They will lose the curriculum that champions their art and no one else's. They will lose the affirmative action that benefits them, right? Because affirmative action exists for everybody, for white people. It's always existed. What we're saying is we want to now have that privilege.
And that scares the shit.
Yeah, because all of a sudden what these people feel they're entitled to is with wokeness, it will eventually be taken away. I tend not to defend the word woke. So you've gotten an exclusive there, because I get bored defending it, because I feel like it's, why would you not want to inform yourself of the way that we've all been kind of indoctrinated and misinformed about history and the present, really? Why would we not? It's bizarre.
That's what I mean. Why would we not? Why is that bad? Why are people telling? Why is the government the other day saying there's going to be an anti-woke agenda? So, like,
that's anti-education, you know? Right, it's anti-education. Right. You know, there was that that Black MP quote. Quasi was like, oh, we don't want to decolonize the curriculum. We actually want to teach people about the empire. Like, that's what we want. Like, when we say decolonize the curriculum, we're dying to teach our kids about how empire works. And not just the British Empire, actually. The Chinese had an empire. The Portuguese had an empire. The French had an empire. The Belgians had an empire. We want to talk about empire in the full context of it. The Egyptians had an empire. The Roman, we're dying to talk, you know, I personally would love for people to understand the concept of empire, like the geopolitical concept of empire, and not just think Britain was the only people that did it. But I think Quasi generally doesn't understand woke. I don't think he's smart enough to feel threatened by it and therefore want to undo it. He's so dumb. He just doesn't, he can't get his head around it.
I mean, this is all fine, but why are you buying so much shea butter?
Oh man, because it's wonderful. You should get involved. It's not kinky. It's not kinky.
Yeah, come on. Explain more.
It's not. I have skin, and I keep it moisturized with cream that I make myself. And here's a tip: buy shea butter, melt it down in a pot with some like olive oil. Olive oil is great. Sunflower oil is wonderful for your skin as well. And once it's done, pour it into like a container. Stick that container in the freezer. Okay. Let it solidify. Yeah. If you let it solidify at room temperature, it will become grainy. It's got to solidify really quickly. Take it out the freezer, defrost it. You've got a lovely skin cream. Really? Lovely. I'm 59 years old, Tom. 59. You'd never guess though, would you?
It's not shea, it's shea butter. Is that how you say it?
Oh, shea? Who knows how to say it? Shea butter.
It is sheer butter. It's pure butter. Fuck, I can't believe we've just gone from a 20-minute discussion about the woke agenda to a recipe for a moisturizer. Absolutely brilliant.
I make my own cream, and I've stopped buying from Amazon. I now use a black supplier for my shea butter. That's funny. And there'll be loads of it. So you're going to think this is really quite kinky. It's not. I swear to God.
Sure. Okay, we've got a lovely featherweight lightweight vacuum cleaner here, April 2014.
Yeah, that's for my mum because she lives alone. She needs something that is a light that she can use to keep her house clean. And my brother, I don't know what it is about brothers, but they love to be helpful, but what they do is never helpful. And my brother have bought her this vacuum cleaner once, and it was just so heavy. And she's got mum's got bad shoulders, bad back. So when it broke, I was like, thank God. And I was like, I'm replacing it. I'm replacing the vacuum, and I bought her that one, and she still uses it to this day. She uses that same vacuum to this day.
We bought that. It's a good idea. We bought a new vacuum cleaner quite recently, and my wife used it in our bathroom upstairs. We've got a really small house and a small bathroom, and she just came out of the bathroom and went, she's trying to hoover the bathroom. She came out of the bathroom and said, I've just smashed the bathroom to pieces. And basically the hoover is just fucking enormous and heavy. They're horrible things.
They are. Ghastly things. They don't need to be as heavy as they are. Absolutely not. But that one is the one that you're looking at is almost, it's like a hand vacuum with a stick on it, which lovely is perfect stuff for my mum. It's lovely perfect stuff.
Okay, from Hoovers to 11th of July 2014, Palestinian Walks, Notes on a Vanishing Landscape.
Beautiful book. It's about somebody who is literally watching Palestine be kind of the borders of Palestine changing, and he's a walker. So he spends his time walking, and it's a very sad and moving book. It's weird. The Arab-Israeli conflict is something I try to be opinionated on, but I can't seem to collate as the information that I need to be. There's just so much history, and there's just so too much history for me to even know what I need to read to form an opinion on it. But I try to be empathetic with both sides, and that's a really good book. That just what it's like to look at a country that you used to love just change. Literally change, like have the border just move and, people move into houses that you used to know someone who lived in, and all of, farms being suddenly built in places that you still roam freely through and stuff like that. It's a beautiful book. Mm.
Yeah, there are so many stories, aren't there, from that whole epic saga of human history. And I wouldn't even know where to start. Exactly like you say, I would literally go into that situation and go, like, if someone said to express an opinion on the Israeli-Palestine thing, I would literally be like, so imagine, being live on air. You're on Five Live.
I'd just be like coughing, like, oh, can we, I just have to find some excuse to not talk. But what I would say is human stories are the way to go. So books like that are the way to go. Like, okay, that's hit from the mouths of people who are living it. Like those are the stories you want to start with. And that's true for any history, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely. 21st of February 2015, black double-sided foam tape, a little bit of gaffer tape in your life here.
Yeah, I don't know what I use that for. Possibly to tie up somebody who ended up in the boot of my car.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it's double-sided. Yeah. So why would I want to
tie... So you could tie two people up. So
that's exactly what it was.
That makes perfect sense. Always nice to see gaffer tape. It always just raises a slight question.
I have no idea what I use that for. No, probably an event. I see lots of events. It's like you always need gaffer tape for events.
You need gaffer tape for life. Gaffer tape is one of my greatest friends in the cupboard.
Oh, God. Bloody. The amount of times you think, have we got any gaffer tape in the house?
Let's get some gaffer. Can you bring up the gaffer? I literally said that to my wife. I was hosting a Zoom quiz at the school and I wanted to stick something up in the background. Can you just bring the gaffer upstairs? And at no point did she say, why the fuck do you need gaffer tape?
Imagine bringing the gaffer tape that is going to be used to, imprison you. Like, can you bring it upstairs? Oh, damn, if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't be imprisoned right
now. Oh, shit, I've just dug my own grave. This is fucking awful. Look, hooray, 21st of December, you bought your own toaster. On my mate bought a toaster. Woohoo!
Did I buy a toaster? I don't remember. What colour was it?
It's the Russell Hobbs. It's the 14816.
Oh, is it red? Yeah, that toaster.
No, actually, no, it's not. It's polished stainless steel.
Oh, that would be a toaster for my mum then. That would be my mum's toaster.
Yeah. Buying toasters. Yeah. Christmas time. Great Christmas present.
Oh, God. I hope I didn't buy my mum a toaster for Christmas. That would be lame.
Toaster and a kettle. I've wrapped it up, a little bow on it.
Oh, no. It's mine. I tell a lie. That's my toaster. I bought it. I moved house. Yes, that's my toaster. It's not my mum's. Do you know what? I've got a red toaster now. But oh, yeah. When I didn't live in the house I live in now, when I lived in my old place, I had to move because I got knocked up. So in my old place, that's the toaster and the kettle in my old place, yeah.
Right, okay. So pregnancy brought you a new toaster.
Absolutely. You'd be surprised how expensive pregnancy is. You need all sorts.
Yeah, got to get a red toaster now, I'm up the duff. So when did you get pregnant, please?
The first time round, it was 2018, early 2018.
2018, right. Okay, well, we're not there yet. We're still earlier. We're still in 2016 at the moment. We've got microwaves.
That's 2016 is when I moved house. So I needed to buy. You're going to see lots of house-related stuff in 2016.
Yes, good. We've got an Easy Chime wireless doorbell kit.
Yes.
Setting up home. So were you living by yourself? Were you living with the guy?
I was living, in 2016, that's when I moved to a place by myself. So I was living in a house share. I was living in house shares up until that point. Right. When I moved out of my mum's house, I just lived in house shares. And in 2016, I moved to my own place.
What was that like?
Brilliant. I had a great time. It was brilliant. I mean, obviously, I love my kids, love my partner, but fucking hell, living alone was great. You know, it was just brilliant. Having that autonomy, full ownership of my space, the art I wanted, the furniture I wanted. It was peace. Loved it. I'll happily go on record and say, living alone is for me. It's my life. It's for me, for real. I love it.
I think any sentence that begins, look, I love my kids and I love my partner, that for me straight away, as soon as you say that, I'm like, yeah, come on, tell me. That's exactly how I feel. I'm a big fan of my wife. My children are wonderful. However, I regret not enjoying that more. That's something they say, isn't it? When you've had kids, they like, before you have the kids, they always say, make the most of it, enjoy this bit.
Oh yeah. I mean, like I was 37 when I gave birth to my first, so not super old, not super young. So I had a lot of years to just love, you know, being alive and running around and doing my own thing. And I'm very grateful.
The idea that as soon as you've had kids, you stop enjoying
it. Yeah, it's like, oh God, like it's like going to prison, isn't it? It's like a sentence. But it's a different kind of, you know, because I say no a lot now. Because I I can't because of the kids, really. And also because of my life situation. Like, it's just way more expensive. So I'm like, no, I can't. It's, you know, it's not sustained. You know, when you're in comedy, you get asked to do things for like no money. So you have less time to do that when you need a lot to kind of feed children and keep the heating on and stuff. So that time where my living expenses were sort of quite modest and my time was 100% mine to do with as I pleased, I can't deny how happy it made me. I was really, yeah, it was great.
Oh God, I love looking into your brain. Look at this. This is great. 30th of September, The African Origin of Civilization, Myth or Reality?
Yeah, another really good book. It's about how all around the world, there are artifacts and kind of archaeological wonders that people don't understand, but we know they had origin in Africa. So there were big sculptures in Mexico and they looked like sculptures of African heads, for example. Right, and there's flora and fauna in South America that we know comes from West Africa, but the only way it could have gotten over there is via a boat.
Right.
There were traditions there were Mayan traditions, for example, and depictions of sort of black or brown skinned people who they would only have seen if Africans had gone over there. So this book is basically collates all this evidence that people from sub-Saharan Africa traveled the world before other people. And we know they did because, like, you know, we talk about Britain as a seafaring nation, but actually the first seafaring nations were from the Middle East. The sail was invented in the Middle East. Because obviously, like in modern history, that is the case. Like Britain became a naval power. But for centuries, even millennia before that, it was people from the Middle East and China. You know, the first people to step on Australia who weren't Australians, quote unquote, were Chinese. So the Chinese got there before James Cook. Anyway, but going on from that, that book is basically collates the evidence of how Africans could have traveled around the world. Obviously we don't have any proper evidence because a lot of that stuff was destroyed, blah, blah, blah. But it just collates like all of the evidence that we have that Africans possibly traveled the world way before we even realized they did.
Yeah. And it's such an important narrative.
Yeah, massively narrative. So, yeah. But it just makes sense. Like,
yeah,
The human endeavor and human curiosity is consistent, like, wherever you
and
are.
It's not
in the
exclusive
world.
to white people. That's the thing.
And specifically to, like, kind of like Western Europeans. Like, yeah. It's just, and we know this, like, the Egyptian Empire lasted for about 4,000 years. 4,000 years. Okay.
4,000.
The
British Empire
lasted for 100 years. So yeah. Why are we sitting around thinking that they were just sitting around with this empire, just scratching their bums? Like they were massively into expansion and their own kind of colonialism and domination and education and medicine and science. And we know they were because a lot of what we do comes from this, but we don't always.
But it's just been put on mute. It's just
yes,
been put on
that's
mute.
That's such a good way to put it. That's the best way to put it. It's been put on mute. And they're on the Zoom call trying to tell us all this stuff.
And we're just ignoring
them. The person that runs the Zoom call has just muted them.
Exactly. So you're going to have to direct message
that'd
me,
be,
mate.
I'm going to knit that. That'd be a really good sketch.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. It's yours. Absolutely.
I'll put you in small, like, font 8.
Except font 8. Equally, again, similar stuff. God, this is really... I must make sure I update this. I do a list of everything my guests have bought and I put it on Amazon. I must put this on there as well. They came before Columbus.
Another book about the previous to the other book, like how we have evidence that Africans were seafarers. I should say accidental seafarers as well. So there's a story about the Malian, you know, Mansa Musa, who's like, he's known as the richest man that ever lived because he was, but he had a brother who just got bored one day. So he built a flotilla of ships and he just sort of went on them and just never came back. And there is speculation that he found the east coast of South America. And there's evidence that he may not have done that. And it's all historical. Like, you know, it's happened such a long time ago. No one knows. But it's just, and it's sort of half mythology, half history. But he might have accidentally crossed the Atlantic and he might have ended up in South America. And his flotilla might be the reason why there's so many African descended artifacts and African descended histories and stories in South America. And it's really interesting sort of thesis. And that's covered in that book.
Right. Okay. God, I love it. I love all this sort of stuff. Okay. Moving on now. We're coming into 2018 and April 2018. Pregnancy. Nail it. Sure, that's the best turn of phrase.
I did nail it. I think that's an Amazon book, isn't it? Is that an Amazon book?
Yeah,
not Kindle. Is that a Kindle book?
It's Kindle. It's something a little bit upsetting about it. It's a picture of someone holding their pregnant tummy and it just says, pregnancy, nail it. It sounds like a terrible
way really
to
shit
abort.
Book. There's a lot of shit free books on the Kindle that you can get. I must have paid 99p for it or something. And
you've paid literally nothing on this.
Yeah,
it says 0000.
It's, you know, there's a lot of self-published work on the Kindle that isn't great. And that would be a book that I would have just, I'm pregnant, what do I do? Oh, I'll download some free stuff on my Kindle, I guess. Take my pregnant care, read free literature about it. I really didn't know what to do when I got pregnant. And that's one of the things that I thought would help. It didn't help at all.
Shall I write that as a review?
Yeah.
This didn't help
it
at
didn't
all.
It didn't help at all, yeah.
Nascence sweet orange essential oil. Do you like an essential oil?
I do, yeah. So not only do I make my own skin products, I make my own hair products too. And I think it's important when you do that to add a bit of essential oil just to get a bit of scent, a bit of theatre, add a bit of theatre to your to your aroma. And you essential oil is great because you only need like a couple drops of it and it's super strong. So I add it to my, I think I still use the same bottle that I bought. That's how strong it is. And I add a bit to my spritzer, my hair spritzer, in case you're interested.
You're making loads of stuff. You should set up a stall, for God's sake.
Yeah, maybe. But now we're not doing comedy no more. That'd probably be a good way to earn a living. Yeah.
Selling all the bits. wireless presenter flip pen. Oh, a Casio collection woman's watch.
I have a watch. It's my favourite watch. And I lost it. And I love it so much. I just bought the exact same watch again. And I remember I must have lost that if it's 2017, I would have lost it in Edinburgh. I used to run around that Holyrood Park. It's 5 kilometers, Holyrood Park. So I used to run around it. And then after one run, I got home and my watch was up on my wrist. And I was like, I love this watch so much. I'm going to buy it again. and so I did. And I still have that watch. Just I'm wearing it now.
Oh, it's a lovely tour of your room. I mean, everything you've bought, you still got. You're definitely, you know, from the mini disc player to the watch you lost. I look after my stuff.
My partner, yeah. I jump up the wall because he's just like, he always wants to replace stuff and buy new stuff. And I'm like, no, this works perfectly. Or I'm not throwing it away. Someone might find it useful. We'll put it on Gumtree one day. I don't like to consume things. I know we've just gone through my Amazon list, but I'm not a huge shopper. I don't like to buy stuff. But if I buy stuff, it's something that I really want and that I want to keep.
Yeah, good. Well, that's how we should be doing it. And that is part of the mission of this podcast, is that it encourages people when they're looking at their Amazon purchase history to sort of reflect and go, oh my God,
why did I buy all this stuff?
Which is great. It's the first time, you know, I'm talking to someone and every book I've mentioned, Athena, you're like, yep, this, it's that, it's that, it's that. Whereas, you know, no offense to my other guests, but most of them go, I haven't got a fucking clue. Did I buy that? I don't remember. James Marlon, Black Leopard, Red Wolf, Dark Star Trilogy, book one. Here we are. This will be the first book where you go, I haven't got a fucking clue.
I'm going to say his name's Marlon James.
So oh, Marlon on. James. Yeah, of course. Sorry. James. It says James, Marlon. Marlon James. Now, this is when Marlon James, who won the Booker, didn't he?
Yeah, for Seven Killings. That's the shortened name of it. I forget the long name, which is a wonderful, but I have that book too. It's just probably one of my favourite books. Is it my favourite book? It's brilliant. Oh. It's a great book. It reimagines seven murders that happened at the time of Bob Marley going through quite a fate. Bob Marley was shot at a rally at one point, and he imagines what happened. And around that, there's like seven murders. And it's just elaborate and complex and just gripping. It took me ages to. I'm a fast reader. It took me forever to read this book. And because it's a lot of it's in Jamaican patois, which I do not speak, I had to read pages like twice. And it's just a wonderful book. So anyway, I bought that book off of the back of that.
So this is where he goes into a sort of sci-fi place.
Let me tell you something that's really true. I have not read that book.
Finally, we found it.
I'll tell you why. I've got an immense phobia of snakes. I don't like them. And one day I'm on the tube, really looking forward to reading my Marlon James book. And I put it in my and I hold it and I look at it. And I'm like, there's something on this cover. And it's got like kind of like, it's a bit reptilian. Like, what's on this cover? There's a picture of a snake on the cover of this book. And I'm like, I can't hold this book. I'm so afraid of them. I don't even want to hold this book. So this book has been on my bookshelf for like 2 years.
And I'm just going to take the dust cover off.
I took it off.
Sake.
It's got the same fucking design on the hardcover. I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my gosh. So then I thought I'll get the audio book. So I got the audio book. And every time I use the audio book, guess what comes up on your screen?
You really have got a bad snake thing.
So it's more that particular image I don't like. The image.
Because it's looking right at you. Yes, you've bought the audiobook.
So, but with the audiobook now, even when I turn my phone screen off, because when it's playing, it comes up on the screen. That's just a nightmare. I've not read the book. To be fair, I'm actually ready to read. In fact, the reason why I know I'm ready for it is because I've got kids now and S is always for snake. So when you're doing the ABCs, so I can do that now. So I know
you've desensitized. That's a clever way.
I'm desensitized. Yeah, it's like S is always for snake now. So I'm totally. I'm not over my phobia, but it's not as extreme as it used to be purely because of that. I wish I was lying, but it's true. Like having to read these fucking alphabet books all the time. When you see, you get to T, and I'm like my pulse races. Like what is S for? Oh God, it's snake again. So and the Gruffalo, fucking hell. Literally every Gruffalo book has a snake in it. I don't know why, and it's a very accurately drawn snake with like it's green with bloody the V pattern on them. Anyway, it's desensitized me, so I can actually pick up that book and read it now, and it's definitely something I need to pick up. Marlon James is a wonderful writer. He wrote another book called The Book of Night Woman, which is an outstanding. Oh, it's just such a good book.
I've never read any of his stuff. I really feel you I've got a copy of The Seven Killings. I've got it.
Okay, well, tell you what, read Seven Killings, but because this is a hard book to read, I found. The Book of Night Women is about a slave rebellion in Jamaica that's run by women, basically. And I think it's brilliant. I actually think it's better than the Seven Killings book, to be fair. I do. I think I definitely found it more thrilling. It's a real page turner. So I would, I would say for Marlon James, that's a good one to start with.
Because I do, there's a sense of reading and stuff that you've got to take a hurdle. That it's not easy to read because of, like you said, there's a lot of it's in patois and stuff like that. So I do kind of think, oh God, when I'm exhausted and, you know, I'm lying in bed at the end of a long day with these wretched children, I'm like, I'm going to be asleep within the next 6 minutes. So I need a book that's going to really keep me awake. And if that happens, I'm done for. I'm just done for.
Oh yeah, reading's really hard. That's why audiobooks are great. I think audiobooks are, and unfortunately, because of my Amazon boycott,
You've brought that up for the first time as we come towards the end of this podcast. And this is the interesting thing, Athena, which you told me when I said you've got to come and do this podcast. You were like, yeah, but I don't use Amazon anymore. let's crash into that, because as we get into 2020, still buying, stuff, you have a pretty active 2020 on Amazon. Only 30 orders placed over the year. And then in 2021, the past 3 months, only 3 orders.
I think, and they would be Kindles, wouldn't they? I'm just trying to think what I ordered.
Well, yeah, it's all Kindle and audiobook stuff. So
yeah,
it's very clear that the Amazon boycott has sort of kicked in for you. I mean, 13 over the whole year in 2020 is by far...
One three. Yeah.
Considering Alex Zane came on a while back, and in the first 6 months of 2020, he bought something like 350 items in 6 months.
I mean, so this is a really important point. Like, we have come to view going online and clicking around and buying things as just like making a cup of tea. And this is really... not great. It's not great if you look at it from like a kind of a high level environmental environmental point.
It's not a benign action anymore.
It's not benign. It never was. Yeah. You know, consuming stuff is never benign. And anytime you go out and you purchase something, it's not benign. It's had to be manufactured. It's had a resource that's had to be used. And it's like, you know, can you live without it? If you can live without it, why are you buying it? Why is it necessary? And accumulating things is a really bad way to live, just like accumulating stuff for what purpose, nesting.
But I think that's why it's important, defending the hoarder, because I'm a hoarder as well, my wife's not. The whole point of hoarding is that it if you're hoarding, then you're not letting anything out of your silo, so it's all going in, and that gives you a sense of just how much stuff you're accruing, and that puts the brakes on. Whereas if you clear out, if you're constantly getting rid of stuff, that entices you into putting new things in.
I think it's symbiotic. I think it shouldn't be hoarding. It should be buying stuff that you need. So you don't, it's not hoarding. It's I'm keeping that because I need it.
Right.
And then I think getting rid of things should be, I don't need it anymore, but it can have a better home. It can be recycled, or it doesn't work anymore, so I can dispose of it responsibly. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think it's a case of I'm a hoarder, I must love buying new stuff. I think it's a case of if you only buy stuff that you need or want, then it's not hoarding, is it? Because you're just keeping stuff you need and want. And if you convert it similarly, only buy stuff you need and want, then it's not hyper consuming and or being problematic. It's I need this and I want it.
Forget the word hoarding, more keeping.
It's more owning. But
having something.
To be honest, consuming too much and hoarding goes together, because you need to buy the stuff that you hoard. So it's I don't think it's a case of it should be opposition. The two things should be in opposition. If you hoard a lot, you probably do buy too much. And if you are constantly clearing stuff out, you probably buy too much. Does that make sense? Basically,
yes.
Both you and your wife are in the wrong. You're both wrong.
That is definitely true. I will go downstairs and tell her after this. You are fucking wrong. However, so am I.
Yeah.
What I love about this is, well, first of all, you love reading, and so do I. I'm an avid reader. How do you find, right, the combo of, and God knows how you've done this with two kids in the house as we've done this. I'm very impressed. You've clearly drugged them. The combo of being able to read with having young kids around, I find it torture.
It's really hard. It's what the one, two things suffered once I had my children. Exercise, like I turned skinny fat, so I'm just soft as anything now. But like the gym exercise, you just don't get the chance, and reading. So I used to read maybe two or three books a month, maybe four, a book a week. But now if I get through five a year, and I have to make a really determined effort to do that, to literally like sit, I've recently had to read books for a job that I've got. And it was just, luckily they were like young adult books, so they're quite easy to read, but oh my gosh, like, it was just, I've got half an hour. Right, I've got to just race through this book really quickly.
Do you feel your brain fidgeting when you sit down? Do you feel like your brain's just...
Yeah, my attention span was never that great. And now it's just sunk through the floor. I have no attention span whatsoever. But I have I need to get back on it, because I've got these books piling up that I've accumulated that I want to read, but I've not found the time.
Yeah. Well, I think the final purchase that we'll go to then, Athena, and this has been a fantastic chat. This pretty neatly sums up Athena Capelli, right? 14th of April, 2020. Okay. You bought two items. One item is The Divide, A Brief Guide to Global Inequality.
Yeah.
and its solutions. And the other item is some black hair dye. There it is, in a nutshell.
Oh my God, yeah, yeah. Like my quest for like global equality and me trying to halt the aging process. That's so funny. So first of all, let's start with The Divide. Let's pick that up. Yeah. Wonderful book. I recommend it to everyone. I actually bought copies randomly for a couple of people because you've got to read this book. It's a guy called David Hickel, I think.
Jason Hickel.
Who, bizarrely enough, he's a friend of a friend, and I met him a couple of years ago in a pub, and I thought, what a cool guy. And I just suddenly realised, oh my God, he's written this amazing book. And it's basically just explains why some people in this world are rich or some people are poor. And it says, it's nobody's fault. We're not rich because we're special. They're not poor because they're idiots. It's the system. Yeah. And he explains the system really well. And he's an economist, so he doesn't just use quite, you know, like flowery language. He says, these are the numbers. He talks about, can you hear that?
It's fine. Absolutely fine. All right, well, not a problem at all.
Cool. He can just be there crying then. Good. This is what they do. Anyway, great book. Recommend it. And it's just really important in, you know, we grow up with comic relief and we didn't know it's Christmas and all that shit. And it's like, no, this is part of a structure. This world is intended. There is intention in the world's global economic design. And he explains really clearly what that intention was and how it works.
And its solutions, crucially.
And its solutions. Wonderful. And I do recommend following Jason Hickel on Twitter because he is, for me, in terms of the people I try to follow to learn about this stuff, he talks about it in the clearest way and he has the most practical ideas. And he's an academic, which is wonderful. We need to listen to academics. We don't need to listen to people like me. We don't need to listen to influencers. We don't need to listen to movie stars. Academics. They're the ones.
Academics.
You know,
yes.
They're the ones to
the people to in with. Cardigans
yes,
will inherit the earth.
Exactly. Absolutely. Apart and hair dye, I went grey at 14, man. And I've been dyeing my hair possibly consistently for the last 5 or 6 years. And I'm not ashamed of it, actually. I'm going to dye my hair because I dye my hair every 4 weeks. So it'll be done this coming Sunday from when we're recording this.
God, the level of detail, Athena, and just the timing, it wasn't over until the beautiful baby started crying, and then it very much was.
And he is beautiful, but he's really unhappy right now.
No, stop talking about global inequality, it's depressing me.
Exactly.
All right, Athena, I'm going to let... Do you know what? I'm going to let you go.
Okay, thank you. That's appreciated.
I feel like you might have more important things to do than podcast.
I've
right
got
now.
To stick a breast in someone's mouth right now. So.
All right, I suggest the baby. Lots of love. Thank you so much.
Take it easy.
She's just absolutely fantastic. She's so, so funny. She's such a great comedy writer. She's such a brilliant brain. She's such a lovely person. I'm a big fan of the wonderful Athena Kablenyu. Give her a follow on Twitter. It's Athena, A-T-H-E-N-A Kablenyu, K-U-G-B-L-E-N-U. I will put a link to her on our Twitter, @ToasterPod. Okay, so thank you so much for listening, and thank you if you have managed to head over to our Patreon site, patreon.com/toasterpod. Really, really appreciate it. Loads of people supporting the podcast from as little as £3 a month. It makes a massive difference, so thank you very much indeed. If you haven't checked it out, go and have a look, patreon.com/toasterpod. There's a completely exclusive podcast over there where I get together with a bunch of random comics and go over in more detail some of the items my guests have been buying. You can get ad-free access to all of Series 2 and Series 3, and you can get exclusive advance access to next week's episode. So, an episode that's going to be dropping this Friday is the brilliant Jade Adams. She's going to be joining me next Wednesday. If you want to get on that quicker, get to patreon.com/toasterpod and you can get Jade's episode this Friday. Right, can you hear the noise of a man fixing my windows in the background? Of course, someone fixing windows and he's just started shooting a nail gun into the window frame. Is that good? I'm going to go and find out. See you next week then.
GreatBigOwl.com. Hi, I'm Yasmin Akram, letting all of you know that myself and my friend Philippa Dunn and I have released the second series of our podcast, We Heart Worry. Join us for hard-hitting discussions on flashing your neighbours accidentally, looking after a child's pet when they go away, and of course, that most universal of worries, a strong fear of chicken. That's We Heart Worry. Find us where you find good podcasts.